Hello and welcome to episode 23 of WB40, the weekly podcast with me, Matt Ballantyne, and Chris Weston. Hello again, welcome back. We got taken completely by surprise by the comedy short amount of time there was between one bank holiday and another, and completely forgot that last Monday we were both off doing family things and stuff. So sorry there wasn't a show last week. We're back again. Did you enjoy your long weekend, Mr. Weston?
Oh, I did enjoy the long weekend. I enjoyed as much as I could get out of walking around and looking for the sunshine, of which there was some. And it was it has been a busy week. I don't think people should think that all we do is sit around waiting for this podcast to come around. We're busy professional people, aren't we? With very important tasks to do. So yeah, there's a lot of that going on as well. I seem to be inundated with stuff, which is great. So, great. Great to have some time off as well. Interesting, though. I think you raised the point, didn't you? Freelance, bank holidays when you're a freelancer is a double-edged sword. It's fantastic to have some time off, but you'd rather, it's nice to earn money as well.
Yeah, I think one of the biggest challenges with getting into the freelance mindset is to not think of the money that you're not earning on days of holiday. And it's really hard, really, really hard to be able to get into that, because there's always the yes, but I might never get any more work thing going through your head as well. So bank holidays are good because they force you to take a day out. But it can be a psychological challenge more than anything else a lot of the time, I think.
Yeah, definitely. But as you say, it's good that everybody has to take the day off and we can all have a little bit of a rest. So Matt, you were talking to me recently about a bit of work that you're doing about talking to some HR people about robotics, AI, and some of the more bleeding edge technology that's entering the workplace.
Yeah, so I've got a session next week with some people from the CIPD, and they've asked me to facilitate a discussion for them about robotics and artificial intelligence and robotic process automation and some of these machine learning-y type technologies that are kind of at the peak of the early stage of hype before everybody gets totally disillusioned by them all. And so it's got me thinking about, I think at the core, interestingly, what is a contradiction in my own mind about all of this stuff. Now, I don't claim expertise in anything. I think anybody who's self-proclaimed expert is probably a charlatan. I quite like it though when I'm confused by things, because it helps me to be able to think stuff, and then hopefully being able to be confused, I can do the confusion for other people and they can then not feel so bad about it. And the confusion that I see in my head about the whole robotics and AI and machine learning and yada 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 is a dichotomy between two things that I can hold in my brain at the same time and cause me cognitive dissonance as a result. The first one is that this is automation, and automation has been around since the 1700s, and Arkwright's spinning jenny onwards, and we should be used to it by now. And the overriding evidence of automation of anything is that we end up with more work for people, not less. And then the second is that if all this stuff was being automated and it was all so clever, why haven't we seen more of it already? And that those two positions, I think, are both valid. And I think that there's stuff to be learned from both of them when it then comes to thinking about what it is that organisations should be looking at to do, to derive, to be able to take advantage of some of the things that are emerging now, some of the things that might emerge in the future. So let's plunder the first one a little bit and think a little bit about how actually automation has been around forever. I think the way that I'd like to express this most is that actually, if you look at it, there is clear evidence that robots not only have taken over our households, but they also have us completely at their beck and call as well. And those robots are probably more commonly known as washing machines. Washing machines have been around since the 1940s or so. They have become almost ubiquitous since the, I guess, the 1980s, with the strange exception of Albert Square in the East End, where they still have a thriving laundrette. And the thing about washing machines is threefold, actually. First of all, is that they absolutely have us at their beck and call. They do some of the hard work. They do it in a very automated way, but they have us folding stuff and unloading and loading and tendering what they do. The incessant electronic bleeping that they emit almost endlessly. So that's the first thing about them. The second thing is that they aren't seen as robots because they don't look like humans. And there's no anthropomorphic stuff going on with a washing machine. So we don't think of it as some sort of scary kind of thing, which is a bit odd. And then the third part of it, which is, I think, quite peculiar, is if you look at the evidence, the result of home automation with things like washing machines has been that we actually now do more domestic labour than we ever did before. Because rather than washing our clothes once a week, we now wash our clothes every day. You know, there was a time, not within living memory, but not far off, where people would get stitched into their underwear at the beginning of the year and then taken out of it again at the next. And that was the sort of frequency which we washed clothes. The Tudors didn't have great bodily hygiene, but, you know, they created empires and stuff. These days, we've become so enthralled to these machines that we've generated even more domestic labour for ourselves. Labour that might be less physically intensive than it used to be, but nonetheless takes up as much time as it ever has done. What's going on if we think that automation is scary when we've allowed these bloody things into our houses?
I think there's two parts to that, aren't there? I mean, I think automation is, in its truest sense, automation is taking a process and putting a machine to do it. So you've taken something you used to do and a machine does it. Where washing machines are a bit more of a labour-saving device because what they've essentially do, quite as you say, they've changed the process, haven't they? They've shortened the cycle. They've shortened that cycle of how long it takes to get from a bundle of dirty washing to a bundle of clean washing. In as much as you're not having to boil a big pan on a stove, pour it into a barrel, and use a wooden dolly to mash your clothes up until they're kind of clean. It's not that labour, that physical effort that somebody would normally have to do, and the time and the effort and the energy taken to get to that stage has gone away. That's the labour saving nature. They've automated that, but the process then has changed, and you can see the same in lots of industries. Automation of car manufacturing. Automation has done some brilliant things. You can buy a car now and be pretty sure that more than likely the car you buy will be the car the same as the last car that they sold, because it's the process and the quality control is automated to that extent, rather than years ago when you'd get the Friday afternoon cars and things that had gone wrong because people just didn't happen to be working to the same efficiency in the same attention to detail when they build that one. So I think there's lots of good things about automation, but I think that people still want a human to be involved in many cases, partly because of risk. So if you try and automate a process away so there's no person involved, Where do you go for redress if something goes wrong or if there's a problem? You can't argue with a computer, can you? It's like the little Britain sketch. You know, the computer says no. If the person or the process is just completely beholden to the computer, there's no reasoning. There's no way to put your case, really. So people like a person to be involved. And also organisations and in fact the law, they like a person to blame as well. So if somebody's got to be responsible for that, there's all this stuff talked about what happens if your self-driving car knocks somebody over. Well, you can't get away from the fact that somebody has got to be responsible. Somebody's got to have the book has to stop with someone legally, and it will stop with them. So whether anybody likes it or not. So these processes, they will still be influenced and beholden to our particular whims and desires, won't they? I think you can change them and you can take away certain drudgery and you can improve the consistency, but we're still involved and we're still at the end.
So there's something about self-determination, and I can understand a fear of losing our control over things by things becoming automated. But the overriding narrative at the moment seems to be we're all going to be made redundant. All of our jobs are going to be made worthless because of this next wave of automation. And that has been the same call that has been made against every single wave of automation since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. The Luddites, the Chartists, during the 1970s, I bang on about this a lot, but in the 70s, the rise of the microprocessor, everybody was saying about how this was going to lead to knowledge work ending and we'd all be caught up in the leisure society. And not only have we got now more people working in office type environments than ever before, whether they're knowledge workers or not is another matter, but that, you know, the leisure society, certainly in this country, is as far away as it ever has been. What is it about this wave that we think is, why have we still not learned that automation of stuff leads to more work?
Well, it does lead to more work, but not always of the type of work that people can do. So if you go to, once upon a time, you know, even in the 70s and early 80s, there were thousands of people employed in coal mines. By the time the last few dozen coal mines were in operation, they were being operated by maybe half as many, a third as many people, a third as many men employed in those mines. And they were breaking records for the production of those mines because of new machinery, automation, the whole thing. And if you go to somewhere, go to up towards Middlesbrough, go to Peterlee, places like that, you've got whole areas that were fed by coal mining, that had coal mining running through it as an industry. And those people haven't found other work. Those people are communities that have not known work for many, many years. The valleys of South Wales are the same. So whilst other industries have moved in, and absolutely, you know, you go to Sunderland and Nissan have come in and they employ a lot of people now where the collieries and the associated industries used to, but they haven't filled the gap completely. And I think sometimes that's missed. There are swathes of people left behind by this, because while some people can turn their hand to other things, not everybody can. So I get your point. You do tend to find that the economy moves on and people find other things to do, but not always. Now, I think when you look at that particular example of very hard manual labour in coal mines or in the northeast in Wales, you can go and you can do similar sort of roles in the office world. If you're, especially if you're in the kind of banking sector, for example, people, I mean, the banking sector is wetting itself about robo finance and all of these things that are going to come along and disintermediate them away and take their jobs. And it is going to, and I'm not entirely sure where that labor force goes really. It's quite a lot of retraining and rethinking to get that into a different place.
So there's another element of this which I have been exploring a fair bit, is this idea of anthropomorphic representation of robots and automotive technologies. So every single news release that comes out, every single bit of lazy tech journalism has a picture of some humanoid robot associated with some sort of thing that is about machine learning or artificial intelligence, which is something that will be done by a computer using code and digits. You know, it's never going to be a humanoid anything, but there definitely does at the moment seem to be a making it look human makes it even scarier. And maybe that is something that is different about this wave that we haven't seen in the past, because you know, you couldn't make a spinning Jenny or a production line look like a human, whereas you can create a media representation of robots that looks like the scary things out of sci-fi movies.
Yeah, there's definitely something in that. And as you say, the dodgy, sad robot theme is about as common as the hooded, lonely hacker theme that you know, sitting in the dark, which is always accompanies hacking stories. And people have always wanted to create automata that look human, haven't they? And because there is a visceral response to it. Or you could call the Henry Hoover an alternative version, not quite as frightening, but I think because we are now talking about learning in that way, and then there is the obvious sort of leap to learning equals intelligence, intelligence equals some sort of super intelligent machine which will enslave us all and we'll all be doing its bidding. I think that's where people go. There was an example, wasn't there, last year or so when I posted the Boston Dynamics video on LinkedIn, and you just saw the responses, the people thinking that just because they've made a robot walk, it's, you know, it's the next thing you know, they're going to be herding us into human gulags for their entertainment.
And
it's just weird.
Yeah, and the stuff like that, Boston Dynamics, I think that's where it really does become very much the make it look human or make it look like an animal, and it becomes that much scarier than, you know, say I've said to you before that, like, you know, a Boeing drone, which is actually something that will kill an awful lot of people, looks way less scary than a Boston Dynamics pack mule. And yet one of them has been designed expressly to be able to kill people at scale, and the other one is just a thing to get some, you know, stuff carried across an icy surface. It's weird the way in which our brains are able to be able to portray a whole bunch of stuff if it looks a bit. And then that then in turn ties into things like, you know, Ross or Watson for the cognitive computing, or Alexa or Siri or Cortana for the... you know, the kind of the servant computers. And the thing I find fascinating with that, of course, is the deep-rooted sexism that there is within the tech industry, that if it's going to be clever, it's got a bloke's name, and if it's going to be subservient, it will be female. And that tells you all you need to know about the tech industry, quite frankly. But it's a layer of psychology that sits over these things that actually I think needs to be taken apart by people. And I think for non-technologists, really, they need to understand that psychology element of it, because otherwise it all seems really scary.
Well, and of course, you have the bias inherent in the how they developed. Did you see? You might not have seen this today. It was an example of a tweet by Macron after the election, and essentially it was in French, and it was I can't remember quite what it said in French, but it was essentially speaking to his compatriots, being extremely proud and humbled by his elevation to the presidency. And the picture was of it being translated by Bing. Somebody was on Twitter and Bing had translated it, and it said, "My fellow Americans." Now, if there's never been, I've never seen such a great example of what is quite a young field of artificial intelligence or machine learning bias than that. It doesn't mention Americans, of course, in the text. It talks about compatriots, but Bing translates it as "my fellow Americans." And those are the things that we have to. That, honestly, it's not the technology that's the issue. It's who's making it do stuff. That's who the problem is.
So, of course, one of the things that is often cited about why machines and machine learning and artificial intelligence will be so great is because it will free us from wonky human thought that is riddled with biases, cognitive flaws that mean that we can't make straight decisions because we're impacted by our psychology and our worldview and all of these kind of things. And of course, one of the other, you know, challenges within that whole setup then is that you then realise, as with that example of the translation, that all you've done is actually limit yourself to the cognitive biases of the people who are programming the thing in the first place. And so actually these algorithms are as flawed, if not more flawed, because they can be scaled. And that then comes to the sort of second story that I've been thinking about for the session I'm doing with the HR folk next week. And that's to say, well, on the one hand, we know automation happens and it works and it creates more work, so why are we scared of it? But on the other hand, if this stuff was really so close, aren't there simpler examples of things that should be there already? Why aren't we seeing some fairly simple things already in market if the amazingly complex stuff is just around the corner? An example, I've written about this a fair few times recently, that I think typifies this, is why, if self-driving cars, which are the combination of a whole bunch of AI type technologies, if self-driving cars are just around the corner, excuse the pun, why aren't self-driving trains a reality today? And this is something I explored, and I explored it in conversation with a number of people. And it's really interesting what happened. The first thing was, why don't we have self-driving trains at the moment? The answer that came from a lot of people was the unions, which is an indication of how politically primed our society has become about where balance of power exists within the workforce, which I find fascinating. But actually, when you dig into it a bit more, what you find is actually self-driving trains have been around for quite a long while. The Victoria Line, which was opened up in 1968, has been self-driving ever since it was opened. They're not, though, fully autonomous. They operate under driver supervision. And that's the case for many of the existing self-driving trains that exist across metro networks, in particular across the world. There are a few cases of very simple systems that operate totally on an automated basis in the UK. I think the only real example of it at any sort of scale is the Docklands Light Railway, which, if anybody has ever been on it, isn't really a proper railway, let's be honest about it. These ideas about self-driving actually have reached a point, and then they've hit the buffers. I can't believe I just said that. I apologise. I asked my good friend Dan, who's an expert in this, and his very straightforward response was, nothing to do with unions, nothing to do with technology, it's just about money. It isn't cost effective to make self-driving trains. And that comes back to the point you were talking about earlier, which is this idea of accountability, and that actually having a train driver at the sharp end of a train has, you know, there's a whole load of human trust involved in that, and there's a whole load of actual cognitive processing power involved in all of that means that it's a fairly safe way of doing it. And trying to replace that with totally computer-based automated systems, the cost of doing that to set against the risk associated with it is massive. And that's part of the reason why self-driving trains don't exist. But trains are things that don't steer, and they work on a closed environment with very few other users other than other trains, which are all known and scheduled. And in comparison to the road network, it's incredibly simple. And
yet, well, you know my feelings on driverless cars. I don't think that's happening. Again, not because of technology. And the railways, they are closed. I guess so if you go to Birmingham Airport, and I know that lots of airports, but there's a monorail that goes between Birmingham Airport and the railway station, and you get on at one end, you get off the other, and there's no driver. And if there was a driver, they would be very bored, and it would be and that would be an expense. But nobody's going to get on that line. No, it's a monorail. It's raised off the ground. Nobody's going to climb onto that rail. I guess with the rail network, and I've been thinking about this as you've been talking, people do. Things happen, you know, trees fall on lines, things get on the line. And also, I guess, if something goes wrong on a train, you need somebody to say something's not right here. And if the only thing that's going to tell you something's not right here is the system that's gone wrong in the first place, maybe that's it's like a double, when you've got, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people packed into a speeding metal object, maybe there's a dual reason for you know, what's the word, and belt and braces kind of approach in terms of safety. But you're right. It would be much easier to make those things autonomous that don't really have anything coming the other way to worry about. And actually, even if the driver's told there's something on the line half a mile ahead, that might not be enough time for the driver to stop it. The driver can't make a train stop any faster than a computer can, probably slower in many ways. So you're right, it's a good point.
And it's when you then start to look at these relatively simple things that I saw it actually at lunchtime today, coming into the building that I'm working in at the moment, and they've got a manual revolving door. And at lunchtime, it's busy, and it's almost a constant in-out people going through. You think about trying to get robots to be able to take part in that, the simple act of getting through a door. And it's monumentally complicated because it's not just the mechanical actions, it's also all the interactions, it's the non-verbal, almost all non-verbal communication, it's the just a whole bunch of stuff that is a relatively simple thing to do and incredibly difficult to be able to automate. And when you think about automation in a human context as opposed to in totally, you know, automating a washing machine is one thing, and still, you know, they they're okay, but they're still not smart enough to realize that I shouldn't have put that jumper in there. Trying to automate something that involves human interactions as well, that isn't anything other than the most simplest of tasks, is really, really, really very complicated. And you have to, you know, you look at, lifts. Your Birmingham International monorail is basically a horizontal lift. Lift in office buildings are still crap. They don't work very well, and for all the automation they put into them, they break down. But also, they're just as an effectiveness thing. They're not very, you know, they're not very good at it. And we haven't got very far with those kind of things. And that's not just because if it didn't involve people interacting with it, it'd be a way simpler task. If you look at the self checkouts in supermarkets, we've kind of become trained to be able to use those things, but it's taken a lot of training, and it's just they're horrid, still terrible things. Actually being able to do relatively simple things in an automated way, even with some intelligence and some learning involved in it, you have to be able to commit to it with a level of capital expense that's big. So actually, not only have we got to say, is the technology up to being able to do these things, but also, is the money there to be able to automate to that extent? Because once you automate it, for all of the self-learning around the edges, has anybody who's ever put anything like an IVR system into a contact center or, you know, any of those established human interaction type automated things, they take a lot of effort to get in. They take a lot of effort to maintain. They relatively fix your system. They don't have a lot of flexibility. It's like production lines. And they're great if you've got something that you can automate and repeat for a long while. But if you're going to need ongoing flexibility on it, it becomes really challenging.
Yeah, yes, it does, absolutely. And I think the idea that, we heard somebody talk a few weeks ago about the idea of a cobot. So not a replacement for a person, but in a knowledge kind of role, but as a helper to provide information and be intelligent enough to know what information and what things that person needs at that time. And the example I was thinking of is a call center, maybe a bank or an insurance or something like that, where you ring up, and it could be anything. If I ring up my car insurance, it could be because I want to renew my insurance, or it could be I want to make a claim, or it could be any number of things. Now, at the moment, you have an IVR thing, don't you? Plus one for renewals and all of that sort of thing. But if I started speaking to a advisor and I said I've had an accident, A natural language processing machine could provide that person with things that are most likely to be related to what I'm talking about and give them a faster way to get the information they need to be able to process what I'm doing. And that's the kind of thing that would allow that person to maybe handle more queries per day and to do a better job for people. And therefore, you might find it would cause job losses in terms of you wouldn't need quite as many people to do the job, but you wouldn't completely replace those people. I think whilst I'm employed in any capacity, I think we'll still need people to make judgments on behalf of other people, to help other people. The automation is brilliant, absolutely phenomenal. I mean, the idea you can teach a computer something and it will learn and it will get better on its own is truly amazing, but it's way, way short of the sites that have been set for it by many people.
Okay, so with those two kind of contradictory positions, what do we take from that? What we're able to be able to say to, particularly to people who aren't technology managers, although I think even technology managers get bamboozled by a lot of this stuff. What are the things that people should be looking out for when confronting one of these artificial intelligence robotic type technologies and the ways of being able to make sensible business decisions that don't get bamboozled by the marketing hype, which is so easy to do. First one?
I think I would say that if somebody's being confronted by some machine learning technology, AI, it's more than likely that they're being presented with it as a tool to sell them something at the moment, and to be extremely skeptical about the claims that are made for the technology. The technology is brilliant, absolutely brilliant, but it is not a not panacea. It's not a silver bullet for anything. So my that would be the first thing I would say to anybody who's got a question about this stuff.
And a good rule of thumb on that, almost all artificial intelligence and machine learning is actually at its core statistical analysis. And to be able to do effective statistical analysis, you need big data sets. So the first question for any AI or machine learning technology you should be asking for is, what is the learning data set for this? Because if it's not pretty substantial, there ain't enough there to be able to learn from it. The second thing for me, I think, is the thinking about that idea of anthropomorphism. And are you being conned by something being made to look human? See this a lot within chat-type technologies. I think there are some interesting applications for chat-based technologies. There's some interesting applications for voice-based technologies, things like the Alexa systems and all that kind of stuff. But making things look a bit more human by allowing them to interact with us in a more human way enables technology to look a lot smarter than it actually is, because we're stupid and we are very, very vain as creatures, and we think, oh, it looks a bit like us. That probably must be really intelligent.
Yeah, it's a very good point. That's a very good point. And I think my the other thing I'd say is my whatever I always say about IT is that IT, done properly, is there to enable people to make better decisions, because people, when they make a decision, have to work on the information they're given. And if they take too long to make a decision, there's a cost to that. So they try to make a faster decision. Often the faster decisions are made with less information. So if you can bring your IT to bear to get better quality information faster to people, they make better decisions with less risk. And that's really every single IT implementation is for that reason. So if you can use the machine learning, if you can use the snazzy tool, the big data, whatever it is, to bring that to bear, to get better information to people, so that when they change something, or when they deploy something, or when they stop something, they're doing it for really good reasons that they can really hang their hat on, then you will get benefit out of it. But it takes a practiced eye to understand what is the technique, what is the technology that you're going to apply to that particular problem. And as you say, that particular data set, that's where the skill is.
And actually, this brings to something I was writing about last week, which is the idea that and not all challenges, not all problems, not all scenarios have a right answer. And in that instance, actually, what can happen is that the more data that you're presented, the more information you're presented, the less able you are to make an effective decision. It's a concept, as a metaphor I've used quite a lot, the difference between clock-type problems, which are complicated but ultimately knowable, something that is mechanical, that if you root in and get enough data, you can find out what the problem is and then resolve it. And compare that with things that are like clouds, which are nebulous, that change their shape around you as you try to be able to interact with them. And that there is a real risk that if you try to employ machine learning type technologies, or you try to provide more information to people when there isn't a right answer to be had, they could just drown in the information that's provided to them. Analysis paralysis sets in, and actually people aren't able to make decisions at all. Enabling people to be able to quickly ascertain whether it's a clock or a cloud, that's a real skill for people these days.
Well, that was a good walk around the opportunities and problems for technology in that area. Quite enjoyed that. And next week, well, what sort of a week have you got on, Matt? What are you going to be doing that will prompt you into action this week?
Well, other than obviously finishing off the work for preparing for that session with the CIPD lot, I've got hopefully a new piece of work starting off next week, which is going to be helping an organisation look at business change around how new collaboration technologies might be able to help as a facilitator to them helping think about new ways of working in the organization's knowledge-based public sector body that I'm working with. So that's going to be really interesting stuff. I'm also doing a lot of work around, bizarrely, around documents and records management, and some of the challenges there are in the old world of storing records for posterity set against the new world of constantly changing and adapting collaborative platforms where you can't even export. Slack, looking at you. So keep me busy. How about you?
Well, this week, I'm at the end of this week, I'm at the IT Directors Forum, which is an event I look forward to. I'm speaking on one of my pet subjects at the moment, which is Brexit and the impact on IT teams. So I'll hopefully be able to report back next week on how that went and what people are thinking of the current state of Brexit and whether it's going to give them any food for thought in their projects and business change year or two.
I do hope that people are starting to look at this seriously now from a citizen's perspective, because it's obviously something is going to happen, and starting to really now take serious audit of the systems and services that are consumed that might be impacted. We've spoken about this in the past, but I reckon we've got a year 2000 problem, but without a fixed end date and with no boundaries. And that's an awful lot of work coming up for people.
Yeah, I think, sadly, I think there's another year 2000 problem happening at the same time, which is GDPR, which is going to die for people as well. So it's certainly not going to be an idle couple of years.
Well, have fun on the boat, and we'll catch up next week. There we go, another week done. Thank you for joining us. If you want to find out more, you can find us on the World Wide Web at wb40podcast.com, and you can also subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and other good podcasting platforms. See you next week.